From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
The CDC estimates that 1 in 5 people in the U.S. have a sexually transmitted disease. The new data indicate that on any given day in 2018, for example, 1 in 5 people had an STD, totaling nearly 68 million infections. Of the 26 million new infections in that same year, almost half were among youth aged 15 to 24. While many STIs are asymptomatic if left untreated, some infections can increase the risk of HIV, cause chronic pelvic pain, pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, and/or severe pregnancy and newborn complications. Our next guest is Dr. Ina Park, who joins us to help us treat this important, not often talked about topic. Her new book is called Strange Bedfellows: Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Dr. Ina Park, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. It's exciting to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, and I have a feeling you're going to be the one who talks about this in such a fashion that we really walk away from it educated on some things that we often avoid. How often do people really talk about this openly?
You know, I think it doesn't happen enough. And that was my primary reason for writing this book, was that I was hoping if I used storytelling and humor to convey some of the science of a topic that, you know, has a little bit of an ick factor, to be fair, that I might be able to increase some conversation around it. I mean, I think it's one of those things that people actually would rather not talk about. So, you know, among my patients who I see, I work in a sexual health clinic, we certainly have those conversations, but it is a difficult topic for people to bring up with each other.
You're right. Well, since you introduced the thought of humor in this topic, it's sort of humorous that I sort of thought that STDs went away a long time ago, and I know now that it's because it's been a long time since I've been in the 15 to 24 age category.
Yeah,
but they are alive and well and still proliferating.
They sure are, and Lynn, it's never too late to get an STD, so it still could happen.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's reassuring.
I enjoyed your humor also. Watching all the Walt Disney movies as a kid, I never thought about, you know, Snow White having relationships with the seven dwarfs. But as you state in your book, I mean, you're showing all the different examples. If Snow White had relations with Grumpy and Sleepy, and then Sleepy had a relationship with so-and-so, you know, you're talking about how this thing can spread and how pervasive it can be.
Yeah, and you know what? One of the things that I did not think about when I was a young person was not, you know, when you're having sex with somebody or in a relationship, you're not just having sex with them, but also anyone that they may have slept with in the past couple of months in terms of the risk of getting an STD. And the fact is as well that the way people are connected in a sexual network, which is something that we can't see, right? But the way people are connected and the order in which people have sexual relationships actually makes a difference in how fast STDs can be transmitted in a community. And so these are all little surprises that I discovered in the context of researching this book.
And as Lynn stated in the introduction, and as you state in your book, STIs, sexually transmitted infections, can sometimes be asymptomatic. So it's not just who you've slept with in the last couple of months. It could be who you slept with 10 years ago.
Well, in the case of something like HSV or herpes simplex virus, right, if you actually have herpes and don't realize it, which actually majority of people who have it don't realize that they have it, then absolutely you could actually spread something without having any knowledge of the fact that you did so.
Yeah. You must be a lot of fun in a cocktail party, huh?
You know, you'd be surprised that I always wonder if I tell people the truth about what I do, if it's just going to end the conversation. But it's amazing, actually, almost everybody wants to learn more. And when you open the door to talk about sex, people are actually willing to do it.
Yeah. Mm.
Great point. And I'm wondering, well, how about this? I'll pose a question to our listeners. That everyone get in their mind the STI or STD that they think is the most prevalent.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Everyone have it in their mind. The answer is from the expert.
It is human papillomavirus, or HPV, for which we have a great vaccine, by the way.
Oh, so this is a great question. You know, when the vaccine came out, my kids were sort of in the early teen years, and I know there was a lot of controversy surrounding it at that point, but I was tuning in because I was a parent. My kids weren't of the age yet, but getting there. And I'm just wondering if you can take us through why it was controversial and why we need to make sure that all of our teenagers get vaccinated.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's great that you had your mind on it at the time, because getting folks vaccinated before they actually have sex is the most important thing to do in terms of getting the greatest efficacy out of the vaccine. But it was introduced in 2006. And, you know, as we've also seen with the COVID-19 vaccine, you know, every new vaccine always brings with it a little bit of hesitancy about whether or not it's going to be safe and whether or not it's going to be effective. And then when it first came out, you know, it was a product produced by Merck. And a lot of the marketing was around talking about it as a sexually transmitted infection. And I think that made parents concerned that maybe giving this vaccine to their young person might encourage them to go out and, you know, be more sexually active. And then the other thing was they were also pushing and lobbying folks, states to make it mandatory. And I think that really, you know, turned folks off in terms of how intense the marketing was. So I think now we understand that it's a cancer prevention vaccine. It's incredibly effective. And it's also great against genital warts, which, trust me, you know, seeing patients with it, you don't want to have those either. So, you know, it's a great success story in countries where they've actually vaccinated most of their young people, like in Australia. You know, they basically have no genital warts or almost none anymore, and they're going to see great reductions in cervical cancer as well.
If you are just joining us on Cool Science Radio, thanks for tuning in. We are having a conversation with Dr. Ina Park. She has written Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, the History, and the Surprising Secrets of STDs. Dr. Park, you mentioned in your book that non-HIV-related STI medical costs are about $2.2 billion annually, and that nearly 75% of those monies were among women. Can you talk about why that is?
You know, the thing is that STIs can happen, obviously, you know, equally to both men and women, but unfortunately, women are the folks that suffer the most consequences if you have an STI that's untreated. So I'm just going to use chlamydia as an example, because, you know, there's about 1.7 million or so infections with that, and it's mostly asymptomatic in women. The problem is that it can silently creep up into the uterus and into the fallopian tubes, where it can cause scarring, and that can lead to things like ectopic pregnancy and infertility later, and it can also cause inflammation and pelvic inflammatory disease. So that is why a lot of the costs, you know, are borne out by women. And the same is true for HPV, you know, human papillomavirus, is that it doesn't typically cause, you know, problems other than warts in men, you know, on the penis. It doesn't really cause penile cancer that often in this country. But for women, we know that cervical cancer is a problem. And, you know, luckily we have screening tests for that. But, you know, certainly you can see that women do bear a lot of the long-term consequences.
I read an article that you wrote in 2017 in Forbes about how the World Health Organization, WHO, had listed some strains of gonorrhea as its most being on the most dangerous superbug list. And I assume that's because of its high level of resistance. What is the relationship between supergonorrhea, which is gonorrhea that has a high level of resistance to antibiotics, What is the relationship between super gonorrhea and COVID-19?
Well, you know, I'm glad you bring that up. I don't know if you remember, but back in the early days when President Trump was touting the use of hydroxychloroquine for COVID-19, he also mentioned that azithromycin might be effective. And so, of course, a lot of folks, you know, sort of jumped on that bandwagon and used a lot of azithromycin, which is used really commonly also for other respiratory infections. And the issue is that all of this use of azithromycin might have actually put some pressure on the gonorrhea to develop antibiotic resistance. Because if you give enough azithromycin, but not enough to actually kill the gonorrhea, it'll learn to adapt to azithromycin. And therefore, if you try to use it again, you can't. And so in December of 2020, CDC actually removed azithromycin. We used to use it for gonorrhea treatment, but we can no longer use it. And now we are down to one antibiotic left to treat gonorrhea at this point, which, you know, is a little bit daunting when you think about, you know, there's probably over 600,000 cases of gonorrhea in the U.S. That's the preliminary data that CDC released last year. So, you know, we have a couple of other drugs in the pipeline, but, you know, gonorrhea is one of the things we really need to keep our eyes on in terms of antibiotic resistance.
And Dr. Park, are there doctors that have to have conversations with patients saying there's nothing I can do for you because they are because they have this resistant superbug?
Oh, that's dark. No, thank goodness we haven't gone there yet. But may I just say, I don't want to scare listeners because, you know, my whole thing with this book is to normalize the fact that these things happen. And for the most part, we can deal with them or manage them. But I have to say that a couple years ago in England, John, there were a couple of cases of folks who actually had to be admitted to the hospital and had to get IV antibiotics for this, you know, which is a very common and usually simple to treat infection. So we are not completely out of options, but unfortunately, you know, we haven't seen that in the United States. But I just want people to be aware and to protect themselves and don't want to stop having sex, but just be aware that it's out there.
Yeah, exactly.
Dr. Park, along with getting vaccinated, the HPV vaccine, mm-hmm. and other types of preventative measures, condom use is, you know, the next best way, I would assume. How are we doing on condom use? It was my belief that that it's much more prevalent, that people are using condoms. This is very standard practice, but it sounds like maybe that's not the case.
You know, this, what we've seen in studies of youth with the Youth Behavioral Risk Factor Survey, we see that every year actually condom use is on the decline. And I think part of the reason is that for young people, there are other methods of contraception that folks like to use more. And now there's greater use of things like long-acting contraception like IUDs among young people. And so when that is happening, which is great from a contraception standpoint, people feel, you know, like less of a need to use condoms for, you know, protection against pregnancy. And I think that people prioritize that over protection against STIs. And, you know, but you are absolutely right, Lynn. The condom, you know, there's an internal condom, which we used to call the female condom, and then, of course, the standard condom that goes over the penis. That's really all we have in terms of barriers right now to protect against STIs. And so, you know, I want people to take them seriously enough, and I want the condom to have an image makeover and hopefully become a little bit more popular because of this.
Mm. It's funny, that reminds me, an image makeover. A couple of years ago, the Utah Department of Health did this condom campaign, and they had the most hilarious printing of the condom package itself. There were these little messages, and maybe it was a national campaign, but it was so great. It seems to me that would have made a big hit among young people, condom use.
But you know, Lynn, I think you're on the right track, is that I think we need to make it positive and fun. And I do think that is what engages young people in, you know, STI prevention campaigns or condom campaigns, is, you know, hitting folks with messages that appeal to them and not using scare tactics. That's one of the things I've learned, I think, from doing this work in the field for so many years.
Dr. Park, the practice of douching has been around for centuries and primarily, as you state in your book, as a means of preventing pregnancy or curing infection, not simply just for personal hygiene the way every other commercial, it seems, is on TV today talking about it. Which I'm still not comfortable with. I can't even believe I'm asking this question. But anyway, we are talking about douching. What is your opinion on that?
So what we say in our field, John, is that the vagina is a self-cleaning oven, and don't mess with it, essentially. So don't put anything in your vagina that you wouldn't be willing to put in your mouth. And so things that, you know, we, starting from the 50s, when literally women were using Lysol, if you can imagine that, to, you know, now I think probably what is being used for douching is not nearly as toxic, but it's not good for the microbiome or all the bacteria that live in there. And you definitely don't need it. And if there's something going on, because women say, I don't like, you know, the odor, or, you know, I don't like the way things smell, then that might mean that there's an infection there and you should see a medical professional, not stick perfumes and other products in there. There is so much you could do in terms of, there's sprays and wipes and douches. There's an entire industry that is trying to sell you products that you don't need.
Yeah, and on the commercial side, I wish the smart TVs could tell if a guy's watching or if a girl's watching, and you can send me commercials on guitars and on basketball and things like that.
Right. Once you see the ad, you can't unsee it, right? You're like, this is not appropriate for me.
Yeah, it's amazing. Lynn, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a fantastic idea. I love it.
Oh, boy. What is the most surprising thing that you have learned through all of your research?
Oh, wow. It's really hard for me to narrow it down, but I'll tell you one thing that really surprised me in the course of, doing the research for this book, is you guys are both familiar with ABC's show The Bachelor, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so one of the most common reasons that women, potential bachelorettes, are turned away on that show is because they screen all of them for herpes simplex virus, or HSV. And the issue is, and I talk about this in my book, is that some of these tests, these blood tests, actually give false positive results. And if you have what we call a low positive result on that test, those are false about 50% of the time. So what I say in there is, those ladies that might have been turned away on The Bachelor, that test might be a false positive. And, I encourage them to go talk to their doctor and get a confirmatory test. So, it's, astounding that we have a test out there that can give so many false positive results, and then folks are stuck with a diagnosis of an incurable STI for life. We really should be able to do better.
And The Bachelor and The Bachelorette are such intelligent, informing shows. We need to have we need to have as many candidates as we can, right, Lynn?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hey, Dr. Park, before we let you go, we know that you're on a time limit here this morning. I just am curious about whatever happened to syphilis. I mean, remember it? People would become blind.
Yes.
And they die from syphilis. How has it changed over the centuries?
Well, Lynn, there's some parallels to COVID-19 because, back in 1495, there was a huge syphilis outbreak in Europe, and there was no immunity in the population to it. And the same way that we have no immunity to COVID-19 because it's completely new. And so there was widespread death. People were having very, very severe symptoms. And now over time, as well with the advent of antibiotics, antibiotics used to treat respiratory infections and skin infections, they can also be effective against syphilis. And so now we have, much more mild and subtle forms of the infection. It can still, cause neurologic problems and death if you leave it untreated, but that is very, very uncommon now. And it disappeared almost in the year 2000. We were talking about eliminating syphilis. And believe me, Lynn, it is back with a vengeance right now.
Wow, that is so scary. Well, the book is
Sorry, I don't mean to scare you.
She scares easily.
The book is Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. Dr. Ina Park, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.